The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. Asali Solomon's first novel, Disgruntled, a portrait of Philadelphia in the late 80s and early 90s, was named a best book of the year by the San Francisco Chronicle and the Denver Post. Her story collection, Get Down, earned her a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and was a finalist for the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. She teaches fiction writing and literature of the African diaspora at Haverford College. Her new book follows two women who reconnect years after their college days and rediscover themselves amidst the questions asked at middle age. She'll be joined in conversation this evening with Nicole Dennis Benn, author of Patsy and Here Comes the Sun, a New York Times notable book and a winner of the Landa Literary Prize. Thank you both so much for being here.
Hi, Asali. Welcome.
Hi, Nicole. Welcome to you. And yeah, welcome to everybody in Zoom land.
Yeah, we're so excited to have this conversation. Congratulations on such an awesome book. This is now your third novel.
It's my third book, my second
third book.
Novel.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And listen, The Days of Afrikeet has been such a great comfort to me over the past week, or actually months, because I blurbed it in addition to talk. And so I can't wait to share with the audience, parts of this novel and also talk about it as well. So I know you wanted to start off with a 5-minute read before we get into our conversation. So let's do that first and then we'll jump in.
Okay. All right. So I'm reading from The Days of Afrikeet. And so you don't need a lot of background to listen to the scene, but one of the main characters is Lizelle. And she is married to a man named Wynn. And this is a flashback to their wedding. And what's important about Lizelle at the point when she got married is before she married Wynn, she was a lesbian and she sort of changed her life and marries Wynn, and this is the wedding scene. The ceremony at a local Episcopal church had gone well. Though there had been some uncomfortable spaces between his words, the minister, as old and white as a ghost, hadn't said anything too off-putting. Lizelle's mother, Verity, who was aggressively friendly with Wynn and his family, hadn't frowned, and the unity candle hadn't set the altar afire. In the aftermath, wife sighed with relief and leaned against husband, but found that his body felt rigid and unwelcoming. She pulled away to look at him. "What's up?" "Lizelle," said Wynn in a thick voice, "did we just do something terrible? I mean, did you really want to do this?" Lizelle hugged her bare arms, suddenly cold. She felt the complicated underthings from the wedding store cutting into her torso. "What are you asking me? Did you?" "Well, I'm the one who proposed. In fact, I proposed everything from the beginning. I'm asking what you wanted." "Wynn," she said, panicking, a shadow in the corners of her eyes threatening to blot out her vision. "I did what I wanted. What the hell?" She could see the photographer approaching. Wynn's mother at his side, looking worried as always. They were going to take photos with Wynn's rich, racist grandma, who unfailingly called Lizelle Lisa and became irritable when corrected. The other grandma, racist and not rich, had stayed in Fresno. "Well, we can take these expensive pictures as a souvenir," said Lizelle, feeling the spirit of Verity in her, "and then we can hammer out the divorce." "You know that's not what I meant," Wynn said. "I'm never divorcing you." "Isn't it a little early to be renewing our vows?" "That's funny. That's a good one," Wynn said solemnly. In a rough motion, Lizelle took Wynne's arm to make a formal entrance into the hall. She knew he was not seriously reconsidering their marriage, but the conversation gave her the beginnings of a headache. Thinking of the evening as their last date, Lizelle was at turns mechanical and reckless. A smile that did not reach her eyes for photos, gratitude and platitudes offered at all the tables they visited. A stiff first dance to Heroes by David Bowie, which Wynne thought would be cool. Of course, it sounded insane and desperate because the song was meant to sound insane and desperate, no matter how the young wedding singer tried to sweeten it. Nihilism flooding her body, Lizelle drank champagne and played with Wynne's cousin's Daisy's beautiful hair. Then the DJ finally took over, put on Marvin Gaye, and Lizelle invited Verity's date, Mr. Charles, to dance. Verity glared from the sidelines. Lizelle knew full well that Come Get to This was one of her mother's favorites. Mr. Charles was effusive. I think this might be the best wedding I've been to, beside my buddies where Robert Bell played. Thank you, Mr. Charles. Lizelle had heard him speak of that wedding many times, and despite her general distaste for him, she could not help feeling honored that her wedding was in the league with it. You know Robert Bell from Cool and the Gang? You look just like a princess, Mr. Charles was saying. I told your mother you'd find your way. I've been telling her. And don't let anybody say anything to you about the interracial fact, because if you catch a hold of something good, you can't let go. These men out here ain't shit, he said, reminding Lizelle of something Verity often said of Mr. Charles. Excuse me, Mr. Charles, Lizelle said, and headed into the mercifully empty bathroom. She tried to negotiate the full skirt of her ridiculous lace gown. She'd essentially let Verity pick it out, to get herself onto a toilet in a cramped stall. She wondered how many women brewed up wedding day yeast infections in sweat-soaked underwear as she struggled to peel off the $50 slip of cotton. She threw it in the little box meant for menstrual trash and left the stall. Thank you.
Wow, thank you. That was such a funny scene. I mean, listen, and also afterwards, of course, running into Wynne's sister.
No, I really like that scene too, but I didn't want to go on too long.
No, it's okay. Listen, this is your show, so absolutely anything you want to do, even if you want
I'm ready to talk to you now.
All right. So I have a quote here. You know, I was before the show started, I was saying how much these characters, how real they feel. And Anne Patchett actually had said the same thing in her blurb of the book. She said, you know, The Days of Africa is so elegant and fresh, so sophisticated and modern. I didn't feel like I was reading this novel. I felt like I was living it. I loved every minute. And same here. I loved every single minute of it. I laughed out loud. You know, even in the moments that I felt like were meant, you know, to be serious, there was still a lot of humor around it. Oh, and Selena, I was just floored by Selena's point of view. So before I even jump into Selena or even jump deeper into Lizelle, I know that this book was actually inspired by Sula by Toni Morrison and Zami by Audre Lorde, and also Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf. So I'm a huge Audre Lorde fan, of course. So there was a quote here by Audre Lorde that made me think so much of these two women. And I'm going to read it here before we jump into the questions. Mm-hmm. So Audre Lorde writes in Zami, I lost my sister Jenny to my silence and her pain and despair, to both our angers and to a world's cruelty that destroys its own young in passing, not even as a rebel gesture or sacrifice or hope for another living of the spirit, but out of not noticing or caring about the destruction. I have never been able to blind myself to that cruelty, which according to one popular definition of mental health, makes me mentally unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And when I read that that quote again, I'm like, I thought instantly of Selena and the way how she feels about the hurt world around her. So deeply so that, of course, the decision was to put her in a psychiatric ward, you know, because of course there's mental illness around that. But just knowing what you're doing with this book and this character who I really relate to. But also Lizelle, although there was a conversation about the pronunciation of her name, Lizelle, right?
Lizelle.
Lizelle. who struggles a duality that often leaves one mentally unstable as well, you know, in terms of her class. No, she's a completely different class, and of course, struggling race. You know, and this is exhausting emotionally and mentally. And I want you to talk about that, like the decision there, that in that irony within itself, you know, of these two women who obviously there's a lot going on. And I want to know how you came about with them, with putting them on the page and them being so alive. Like, what was your process with that?
So, I mean, sometimes it's hard to reconstruct a lot of these things. I was, before we got on the, you know, before the webinar started, I was talking to you about how somebody made a joke with me about the book and I had forgotten something in it. And when I was like looking over it for things that I was going to read aloud, a lot of it, I mean, it's almost like a distant memory you have of writing these things. You're like, oh, I guess I did this because it's here, but it's almost like something was happening to me. But as far as creating the characters, I think that, you know, the first thing that came to me in this book was this, the first image in the book, which is like Lizelle taking a phone call from her mother who's basically scolding her. And that was like the first thing that came to me on the page, and it moved out from there. But in a sense, I created their characters together because I wanted to create these two Black women. There's a passage in, I mean, I think it's at the very beginning of Zombie, actually, where Lord talks about, you know, like the many women who'd sort of been through her lives and left their imprint on her and that kind of thing. And it's also true of Zombie that at the end, the relationship with Kitty or Afrikiti is also a brief one. And like it's, but what's kind of interesting about Lord is her idea is that these brief relationships are just as important as longer relationships. And so, in a sense, I created these characters together as two people who had really shifted each other's lives in a sort of brief time together. And I wanted them to be sort of complementary in a way. And so that's the idea of one who's like sort of so sensitive to the world that she almost cannot get on with her life. And the other one who could go that way, but decides not to, right? And that they're sort of complementary to each other in that way. Like one who's sort of unable to build up an armor because it would sacrifice like a sense of empathy in her that I guess is like necessary for her survival. And the other one who has spent a lot of time building up an armor. And in fact, by the time we arrive in the novel, has built up an entire life as an armor in a sense.
Yeah, I got that. And even what you just said about Afrikiti and you know her significance in Lord's story, I thought about Selena being divine. You know, that was a very brief encounter between the two women in undergrad. You know, Selena, Lizelle was on her way out as a senior. Selena had just entered. And so that very brief affair was something that was significant in both women's lives. And I just thought that was so endearing that this was a relationship that lasted. And it reminded me again, of course, of Sula and Nell, you know, that relationship that Toni Morrison had built between these two women. You did it with Lizelle and also with Selena. Mm-hmm. And it's the importance of these relationships, romantic or not, you know, between these two Black women. So one of the things I wanted to ask you then, because you know, when did it occur to you that, you know, this scene that came to you was in the, between Lizelle and Verity on the phone, but when did it come to you that I want to actually base this book on Zami, Sula, and Mrs. Dalloway?
Well, so it's hard to say, right? So I would say that the first, it was kind of interesting because I think Zombie kind of came last, but and Mrs. Dalloway was less of an issue of me necessarily engaging in a conscious way with the themes of Mrs. Dalloway and more thinking about how much I like the structure of it. So I like the structure of it because, you know, you have this really bounded, you know, scene that's happening in the present.
Yes.
But from there, you can sort of like jump all over around in time, you know? And
right.
So there was something extremely elegant about that, that like, you know, sort of apropos of nothing, I just started thinking about. And then I reread the book and I was like, yeah, that is a really sturdy and interesting structure. And you know, it is true that as you go through life, you're having your day, but you're living a bunch of other days all the time.
Yes.
And so I was really interested in that kind of architecture, like the with the architecture of memory, let's call it. And I also, you know, I kind of had this like joke with myself about how like there were too many dinner parties in American, in like mainstream American literature. But yeah. I was like, and then I just add another one to this, you know.
Yeah, which I thought was brilliant, by the way.
It's like the dinner parties are totally overrepresented in American literature, the way like murder is overrepresented in movies or whatever, or in TV shows. Just like how many, So I like the idea of that, but I also like the idea of doing that with like these characters, you know, puzzling through their issues. And then in terms of Sula, it's hard to reconstruct a timeline of this, but I do know that, you know, that's definitely one of my all-time favorite books. And like for so many reasons. And I think that I had worked with a couple of students on like theses about Sula, and you know, they were sort of like thinking about, you know, a book that was about this two women who their most significant relationship was with each other, but it wasn't a book about romance, you know,
right?
And thinking like, well, what if, you know, what if it was, what if romance was in it, you know? And so it was just kind of like a what if. That was a kind of tribute and an engagement with Sula. And then I think Zami kind of came naturally, but I think thinking about like, the reason I was thinking about that book, and it's kind of funny because a lot of this, what we're talking about right now is like literally just in the book in a conversation.
Yeah.
But one of the really interesting things about Zami is when Lord talks about how like, you know, she was in these communities that were majority white women. Uh-huh. And the Black women would sort of move around the edges of the circle, and they might sleep together, but they didn't really have relationships because it was too painful. And yeah, so like, I was just kind of interested in that too, in the fact that like, you know, in terms of being in romantic relationships, as Black people, you're like, there's a lot of difficulty that you're dealing with, right? And so you can bolster each other, or it can become very difficult, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, my thinking about Lizelle particularly is that like, that was something that was really hard for her, right?
Yeah. And, you know, again, Asali, just a comic of your work, because, you know, there's an inside joke, there's an inside lesbian joke with all of us, actually. You know, the woman who's Lizelle was described as the wolf on campus at Bryn Mawr College, which ironically, I mean, my wife grew up in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. And we delighted in the fact that your book, we're sharing your book right now. You know, she has it reading. And I, the fact that Lizelle was described as the wolf, right? And the irony of her marrying a white man, or not even a white man, a man, right? Yeah. And it's like an inside lesbian joke that actually became public. With this book, because Lizelle ended up as that woman, as that girl who we all know in college, you know, who was doing all these women, and then she ends up in a heterosexual relationship, and actually the most rigid of them all. And so I love what you did with that. I don't know if that was intentional in terms of what you were doing with Lizelle's character, but
I mean, it wasn't, and I wasn't privy to the joke, but I will say it's funny because she makes a comment like, you know, she's mad, like when they call her the wolf, she's like, oh, these are exactly the white women that are going to go off and just like, you know, go on ski vacations. And then like,
right. You know. Talking, right. Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. I really appreciated that. Seeing that then. Knowing, and just knowing you actually explained this really well. I mean, I got her too, like in terms of the armor that she has to build for her survival. And it's so true, because one of Lizelle's biggest fear is being Verity.
Yeah.
She doesn't want to be like her mother at all, you know? And so I feel like every decision that she has made, be it subconscious or conscious, is away from Verity, her mother, who I felt like was a dynamic character. But a character that Lizelle really fears. And at one point, Selena even said to herself, like, but what's wrong with Verity? You know,
yeah, right.
What's wrong with Verity, right? You know, but Celine, Lisa really abhors Verity's character. She doesn't like her. She loves her mother, obviously, but just doesn't want to be her mother. And that's, I understand that, you know, in terms of that armor that she's building. And, but opposed to that, Selena has another older woman in her life who she aspires to be in terms of the sexual freedom, Auntie Baby. And so I want you to talk about these older women in the lives of these two Black women on the page, the influences of these two women, Verity and Auntie Baby.
Well, I think it's like, I mean, this is another thing that is really engaged with Sula, which is that the idea was that they came from two houses that the other one would have wished that they could have lived in.
Yes.
Right. And so that was actually like a big part of the construction of their families, you know?
Yes.
And it's not like, you know, I don't think the thing with Verity and like the thing of Selena's house is she's so lonely, you mm-hmm. know, because her mother is so sort of her, I mean, her parents are together. Because they're going to be together, but they're living in a war of a relationship, right?
Yeah.
And then there's so much propriety. There's so much talking in, you know, like talking, you know, not talking around issues. Whereas Verity, you know, I still laugh at my own joke where Verity would be in the supermarket and be like, "Is something wrong with your bowels or whatever?" Yes. Just like so, like you know, for Lizelle, it's like horrifying, and she feels like there's not enough of a boundary between her and Verity, you know?
Yeah.
And Selena would want something that like was much more straightforward. And so, you know, I mean, I just think it's really like, it's one of the things that I always do in books is like, I don't quite understand plots that don't register a sense of like where the characters came from in terms of family. Yeah. But I mean, I imagine some people lead very distant lives from their families, but even when you do that, they still have shaped you. And yeah. So I really always think about like how the, and there's even that one scene with Wynn's family, just like, okay, this is the sense of who this person is.
Yes.
You know, and so they're looking at these women and they're not consciously moving away from them or conscious, but definitely like learning about them.
Yeah.
And being created in whatever they're learning about them. And so, yeah, so Selena has her mother, Alethea, then there's Aunt Baby. And, you know, I also was interested in the way that like these things that seem really small in childhood, like, you know, if somebody had told Alethea, like, oh, do you know that this sequence of events maybe has its root in California when Selena heard this thing in the night? Like, you know, what are you talking about? You know, and so I think that, like, that's, you know, that was, like, an important part of the construction of it was having these different models that they basically were trying to either move away from or unconsciously imitating in one way or the other.
Yeah, and you know, even the I say to my students all the time in terms of seed planting, you plant so many seeds in the early chapters, and the seeing these seeds blossom as you water them, because one of the other big seeds that you planted was sexuality. You know, mm-hmm. You know, Selena seeing Aunt Baby for the first time, having or just her foot underneath some man, mm-hmm. and got instantly, you know, was attracted to the idea of mm-hmm. sex, but mm-hmm. not necessarily liking it, but attracted to the idea. Until mm-hmm. years later, Auntie Baby said, "Oh, I don't care for sex that much," you know.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was really well done. Mm-hmm. And even you know, you do this all often in your work. Even in that New York Times review that I read this morning, that was so on point with your craft. You have an ability to have your stories just beautifully unfold. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, this is the day in the life of a woman or the night. You know, her dinner party, but so much unfolds. And by the end, by the time you get to the end, and I don't want to give away the ending to those who are going to be buying the book tonight, mm-hmm. but by the time you get to the end, you're like, oh my God, like each fabric is like so well stitched and ironed and starched. It's like amazing what you do craft wise. And so I really commend you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. And there's also the effort that you put into each character. Like you also mentioned family being important. So we saw Wynn's family and what, you know, what he comes from and, you know, on the main line, you know, the furniture, the dark furniture from different eras or centuries, you know, bequeathed by older grandparents, parents. And then, of course, but versus Lizelle's family, Verity, who, you know, from Philadelphia, I think, was it West Philly? Or
Yeah,
West Philly, right? And another thing that you do so well in your works, especially in this book, is straddle class lines. Like, the class dynamics is so palpable. Like, I feel like I saw like, even down to how, you know, immigrants are treated. You know, you do have Lizelle, who has this woman who's working for her, and her daughter, who's obviously a PhD student, but, you know, on her hands and knees scrubbing the floors and doing the dinner party stuff. And so you have a good commentary on class in America. I feel like most people, most books you'd read, it's like, oh, race, you know, but the class part is kind of hidden a little bit or implied. You really went in with class. So talk about that some more in terms of your coming up with, or even like having that in the back of your mind as you craft these stories, especially this novel.
I mean, I'm just really interested in these forces that shape people's lives, you know, and I think that one of the things I was really interested in this book, and I've always been interested in this, because one of the things when I first started writing that I really wanted to do was explore intra-racial relationships, like relationships between Black people, you know, Black people of different colors, Black people of different classes, Black people who spoke differently from each other, you know, this kind of thing. There's so much fabric and drama in there. A lot of it being shaped by racism, but just like interesting in and of itself. But one of the things that I still think there could be more of is thinking about, like, if you're, even if you're writing about race and racism, first of all, you could write an entire book about race and racism just about Black people. Like, you don't even need to, you know, and so that's kind of, I was, you know, I've done a lot of that. But also, like, if you're writing about race and racism, it's also just not like about Black people and white people. That's not where we are, right? So I thought it was really interesting in particular that, you know, she has like the this Mexican-American woman who works for her, the daughter who works for her. And also thinking about Lizette, so the daughter, Xochitl, is a PhD student whose mother is a housemaid. And so, you know, she's on an upward class trajectory. And it's an awkward situation for Lizelle, who's somebody who didn't grow up in a house where anybody, like, you know, I mean, maybe the plumber would come, but there was certainly wasn't anybody who was going to do work around the house. But also, they should be somewhat simpatico, because they're both like on this upward trajectory in some way, right? And yet there's this like weird tension between them. But one of the things I wanted to write about was that, I mean, there have been, you know, since the beginning of the country, you know, there were free Black people, you know, there were upper classes, whatever. In some ways, you know, that's expanded, obviously, but like there are different issues that arise, right? When people are able to attain a certain level of status. And while certainly, you know, there are things that are just as threatening to Black people with money that are threatening to Black people without money. You have a different set of dilemmas and responsibilities if you're a Black person. You can't just be like, well, you know, I'm Black, so that means I'm ultimately sympathetic in whatever situation I'm in. Like, you know, like, but I also like the idea of presenting that as like a tension that couldn't really be resolved, like Lizelle really couldn't resolve, you know.
Yeah, and of course, in typical Asali Solomon fashion, it was a joke. I mean, like even though the description, you know, her being this woman fanning across the gold, like the description of her being the mistress in the big house, you know, looking at the work and the fields, you know, I just love the descriptions around that. As well. And all the characters have some kind of mystery to them, because there's also this, I get the sense of this house, this helper, she kind of looking down. I mean, Lizelle is so vulnerable. Yeah. I mean, she might not exude that, you know, but I feel like in her, just the way how she feels, her insecurities. Mm-hmm. And I do feel, you know, the person like just looking like, oh gosh, you know, kind of shaking her head, like, poor you.
Yeah,
you know, right. So I felt that. I really felt that. And another thing that also that I wanted to even touch on, because I feel like when I'm looking at the characters in scene together, there are times when I said, well, yes, because I love when these two women were in scene together in their flashbacks of college life. Mm-hmm. From meeting the first day, in this English class, in this literature class where, Black women writers were being taught, the fact that there is this, Lissell dropped the class, and Selena stayed. And there was this, I don't know what you do in terms of that relationship being built from there and then moving forward as a romance that of course fell short, but there was something mm-hmm. beautiful in that intimacy. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation that you were thinking about the what ifs. What if Sula and Nell really did hook up? What would that look like for you? When did it occur to you that Selena was going to be the one to just not be okay? Like, in terms of her falling out, like, did she drop out? She dropped out of school.
Yeah.
And yeah, walk me through Selena's characterization. And I love that you gave her own POV, mm-hmm. but walk me through her, that decision or not to have her go in that direction.
You know, it's funny because it wasn't a decision like that. It was like, that's the way the character came. The way the character came to me was somebody who was like extremely fragile and because she was just really susceptible to, feeling too empathetic or feeling too absorbed by like, basically evil in the world and historically evil in the world. And the reason I was thinking about that was just because I think that like often when and I think especially in our sort of contemporary life where we're really inundated with news of what's going on down the street that's horrible, but also what's going on, around the world that's horrible. And then also what's going to happen to us in the future that's horrible is a lot, right? Yeah, so, definitely. But it's considered sanity to be able to absorb all that and keep going, mm-hmm. right? And so I was just interested in the idea of somebody who like was actually responding to these things the way it would actually more make sense to respond to them.
Yeah.
Like, what if you actually took it to heart every time you saw somebody on the street who looked like, that they were about to die, or what if you took these things to heart, but like, it's right. actually considered, I just thought that was a kind of interesting idea. And that came to me at the same time as the idea of the character came to me, actually.
I love it. And to what extent is research a part of that? Because even though to the meds that she's taking and what the therapist is telling her and all these things, it's so real. You really feel for Selena in this book. And that's what I want to even get across to the listeners. You feel for Selena in this book. I really, I'm like, wow, this poor woman, from her dropping out of Bryn Mawr, going to some other school or dropping out of that school as well, to mm-hmm. ending up doing menial work. And living with her mother who's braiding her hair like a child. I remember that description. But also the heart of Selena, it's so, I felt that because even when she was describing her relationship with Lissell, there was, again, sexuality. She said, even though she didn't care, there are times when she faked an orgasm, for example, but she wanted to get up and hurry up because she wanted the cuddling. And I just found that so endearing. She really loved Lissell. And so I could tell that was her rock, even in the midst of her mental chaos, that was her rock. And so that came through really beautifully in the whole story. Yeah. So thank you for that as well. Yeah. And so, and what you just said made sense. It's really realistic how we should be going, we should be reacting. Every time you check Twitter, there's always something. So now I'm going to now shift kind of a little bit from the storylines in itself this is research, but in terms of what you want readers to get from this book, what do you want readers to take away from this book, The Days of Africate?
So, I don't know that there's anything particularly, like, I like to say that I'm hoping that people who read my books, it helps make them more human. And then I think the other thing is, like, if people are laughing, like, I'm extremely happy about that. That's like a really big thing. And I think also, like, you know, like, I recently, and certainly in the last couple of years, I definitely have spent a lot of time thinking about, like, the enterprise of writing and, like, what is the point, you know, because you're looking at all these other things happen and you're like, oh, you know, like, should I be doing something a little more useful? But what you reported to me was that, like, it was a really, really transporting experience, you know? And so I'm hoping to give people, like, rather than a certain kind of message, like a really transporting experience, and then hopefully some questions that they can sort of think about. I mean, one thing that I definitely, like, was just, like, straight up kind of didactic about was, like, there's that scene where they start talking about North Philadelphia. And, you know, Lizelle basically is like, oh my God, these conversations, it's like people are talking over just, you know, mountains of just horror and covering up with words like family and schools and safety and kids, you know? And like, that's something, you know, I want people to think about, like, when they have these polite conversations about, you know, that are essentially covering over, like, racism or, you know, just other kinds of disenfranchisement, like, but that's something that I just think is kind of interesting to think about. But, you know, I think that, like, I mean, I hope people read the books that I'm sort of, like, in conversation with, and, you know, hope that people sort of find in it questions that they that they find interesting.
Yeah, I Sally, I love that you don't hold back. You don't hold back at all. In fact, yes, through the humor, there were so many truths that were said, that were written, and you didn't hold back, you didn't shy away, you didn't even cross out, you know, in the editing process, like, oh no, so-and-so is going to be offended, let me take that out. You didn't do anything. It was just all there, like, boom.
You know, should I have held something back, do you think?
I love it so much, because it makes us sit uncomfortably in these truths, you know. I think the best writing is when you are able to be uncomfortable yourself as a writer, like writing through that, but also allowing the readers to sit uncomfortably in these truths. And so I appreciate that. You know, it's obvious that you're not pandering, you know, to an audience. You're like, oh, look, here it is. You take it or leave it, you know? And so that's why I appreciate this book so much, because yes, I was laughing out loud, but I was also nodding my head like, yeah, that's so true. That is so true. Yeah. So again, you did so well with this in terms of the truths. And another thing that I wanted to ask you as well, in terms of, you know, having a book come out is one thing, you know, there's anxieties. I mean, Disgruntled came out, I think it was 2015 or 2016.
2015,
right. Disgruntled came out. And then bam, here's the Days of Afriki in the middle of a pandemic. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it like to drop a book in the middle of a pandemic? Like,
I mean, you know, it's funny because I think, like, at some point it was meant to actually have come out like a year ago or whatever. And when that wasn't happening, I was really relieved because I was like, oh my gosh, like I can't even, you know. So honestly, like, this seems, I mean, I don't even know, like, can we still call this a pandemic or do we just call this life?
At
this point we're calling it life, and so and it's really like, at this point life is about, like, you know, hopefully good things we'll have some good things that will happen occasionally. And so, you know, it's actually for me like a fine time. I mean, of course I wish I could be in person with you, you know, and doing that kind of thing, but in terms of, like, it actually is, like, I think that, you know, I'm glad actually to have a book that people can, you know, read right now when things are still so stressful. And I think that the other thing that was, like, heavily on my, I mean, I wrote this, I actually wrote basically the draft of this book, the first complete draft of this book in like 2018 or something.
Wow.
And at that time I was like feeling stunned and traumatized by the election, or it was 2017. So that was the sort of trauma, but I specifically engineered the book to be set before Trump's election in a time where no one knew all of the things that were about to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Verity was even having problems pronouncing Barack Obama's
name. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So in a sense, they're so innocent, right?
Yes.
And at the same time though, there's this note in the book, and this was something I conceived even in 2017, of everybody feeling like, you know what? Something is really about to go off the rails. Like, this is all about to end. We don't know what this, you know, whatever we're calling this, is about to go off the rails, you know? And so there's a moment where Selena's in the rain and she's like, yeah, you know, this whole world is going to fall apart, and then I'll be on the same page with everybody.
Bye.
And so,
And
so it's kind of funny, like, when things really started to get dramatic, you know, I was like, oh, because, you know, the book, I was still like, you know, sort of like revising and all the kind of stuff, but all that, those essential things were already in it, right? Just like a sort of premonition about future disaster.
Interesting.
You know? Yeah. Woo.
So, wow. So next time I'll be like, okay, I saw it. Can I read a drop of your book? This is like gonna sense of what's gonna come in the future. Yeah. No.
Yeah. I mean, all I had to do was read New York Times articles about climate change. It wasn't it wasn't like Nostradamus, but
all of that.
Yeah.
Man. And I mean, and then finally too, so you have a PhD in literature,
mm-hmm.
Obviously. Who are your literary influences? I mean, aside from Virginia Woolf, Toni Morrison, and Audre Lorde, mm-hmm. you know, because I read somewhere that you'd also teach your students literature by women of color, which mm-hmm. I commend. Mm-hmm. So who are your literary influences?
I mean, I have tons of literary influences. Everywhere I go and everything I do, I always talk about Maud Martha, which is Gwendolyn Brooks, the poet, wrote one novel. It's Maud Martha. It's my all-time favorite novel. And then, you know, I've been teaching in a recent course of Black memoir, June Jordan's memoir called Soldier, A Poet's Childhood, which is like an incredible book that I don't know if you know how a lot of people read, and just like the sort of ingenuity of that book and the craft of that book is something that is really important to me. Lucille Clifton, the poet, is one of them. I can't properly call her an influence, but I feel like at this point I've spent so much time reading her work that it's probably just like in my body.
Definitely.
And like, also when I'm tired and I'm like, oh, I have this teaching job, I have these two children, blah blah blah, I like think about her, like six children, just like,
I know,
and, you know, I know, I mean, I don't think they make them like that anymore, I like, you know, I think about her, and there's other, like, there's a book by Mary Gateskill called Two Girls, Fat and Thin, that I think is actually slightly in this book. What?
I need to read that.
Oh, yeah. No, you should definitely read that book. And Linda Barry, you know, her novel. So the novel Cruddy, I wouldn't say was an influence on this, but she has a book called What It Is that's about writing that I think about a lot.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, there are many, many others, but those are some of the ones that come to mind.
Oh, well, no, you're one of my favorites, because I love this book. I love Disgruntled. And I felt like, you are, you know, one of those authors who, like I said, you just come in and just deliver the work unflinchingly. Like, you just give us these characters that are so memorable that they are part of our families now. You know, they're aunts, they're mothers, they're neighbors. You know, so you did that so well and continue to do that really well.
But that is also really true of you being unflinching.
Oh, you know what? Thank you. I try. Yeah. I really try. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because one of the things that I you know, I always think about, who am I writing for?
Right.
And, you know, I write for me first. Mm-hmm. I know you know this, you know, writing the books that we would have wanted to read, mm-hmm. you know, growing up. You know, mm-hmm. And so that's first and foremost, mm-hmm. For me, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Asali. So now it's 8:14. I'm getting a nudge. So I'm gonna now open it up for audience Q&A. Mm-hmm. So let me just read a few here, which mm-hmm. It's coming in. So Steven, he says, hi Asali. I love the Lorna Simpson collage on the cover of The Days of Afrikaans. And I wonder if you're writing in conversation with her work as well as Wolfe's and Morrison and Lord's.
Huh. Yeah. So first of all, hi, Stephen.
Oh, you know, okay.
I know Stephen. So, you know, that's a really good question. I wish I had a better answer to it. I mean, this collage came up, you know, as one of the options for the cover, and it is incredible. And I think that what Lorna Simpson does, and I guess, I mean, basically this question is an elegant way of sort of thinking about the multiplicity of Black women's identity, because yes, that's so much of her work is about the multiplicity of Black women's identity and like what these different things look like. And I think, and like, just really like exploding any notions of flatness or sameness, you know, and that's really something I do a lot. And
yeah,
not really as similar to Lorna Simpson, not as like a public service announcement, but because it's about beauty and, you know, being interested, you know, it's just like Black women are a rainbow of fascinatingness, you know? Yeah. And so that's, you know, that's some of what she does in her work. And I guess that's something that I've tried to do in my work as well. And so the cover is just like one of my absolute favorite things about the book.
Yeah, it's, you know? Beautiful. Beautiful, by the way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you for that, Stephen. And then Karen Jordan is asking, hope to read your book that I ordered today and enjoyed as much. Thank you for wishing, thank you and wishing you much success. Okay, so that's a statement. And then Mary Mayer says, thank you for all of this. I'm interested in the idea of these books that you're in conversation with while writing your book. What questions did you continue to turn over after reading Sula, Mrs. Dalloway, and or Zami?
So, I mean, I think like one of the questions that I think in Sula is like, and this is a weird thing to say, but Sula is almost like a like biblical text or like sacred text or something.
Yes.
But not in the way that like, I love it so much, it's so great, but in the way that like, you read things and you're like, wow, I have no idea what that is, but it feels like something heavy. You know, like there are all these little things in the book, like, you know, and this is something that really happened to me, like, you know, when I was studying literature, I've read that book 100 times, but there's still things that I'm just like, I don't quite understand this thing, but it feels so important and real, you know, the Deweys, or, you know,
yes, when
the little drowns, or, you know, just so many, they're almost like symbols and parables, and, you know, and so it's like, so there's these sort of little questions there, but there's also a question about how to construct a work like that. And that's something that, you know, I'll figure out maybe when I'm 86 and whatever, but like, how do you construct something that feels so weighty and is kind of, you know, like has deep emotional resonance, you know, but also these things that you almost feel like you're just accessing them in the way that you access dreams, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I think, and, you know, one of the interesting things about Zombie, when I read it as a grad student, was that like, the question of memoir often is like how somebody chooses to begin and end a memoir, and particularly something like that, because there's such, and it is, you know, Lord calls it a biomythography, because yeah, there's, it's not, even though it's linear, it's not a linear representation of her life, you know, because right, it's like you read that and then you go and you're like, oh yes, and then she married a white librarian and blah, blah, blah. And then later, blah, blah, and you're like, what? That is Zami. But like thinking about, you know, what are the most, you know, what is the, what are the materials from your life that you want to sort of make stories out of, you know? And so, you know, for a long time, I thought about what, you know, what she was trying to communicate from the specific stories that she chose in that book, you know?
Yeah.
Because there were so many other ones that she could have chosen.
Exactly.
So, I mean, those are some of the questions that still remain with me about those books. And for Mrs. Dalloway, I think it's another question of like, I'm still not even sure why that structure is so compelling, you know? But there's something very compelling about that structure.
Yeah. And, you know, even as you talk about Toni Morrison, you know, teaching her books in my classes, you know, I noticed that Toni Morrison, she breaks the quote unquote rules, you know, she knows the tools, she knows the rules, but she breaks them so many times. And I just think that's so gangster, the way how she can just write something and it's like, whoa, you know, for example, in craft, right? We learn separate points of view, like, oh, give so-and-so their own chapters and, you know, that's how you organize. But in Toni Morrison's works, somebody else's point of view could have slipped right in a paragraph and like, did that just happen? You know, and it's nothing but a thing.
Well, the other thing about Sula, which is like one of my all-time favorite things, is that Sula dies and she's still thinking about
death, right?
It's like, but she's dead. It's like she died and she's like, oh, that didn't even hurt. Wait till I tell Mel.
Right. Yeah. I just love the permission. She gives herself so much license. And I love that. And that's why she gives me license. And I feel like when I read her books, I'm like, all right, yeah, I can totally do this. You know, without even worrying about rules. Like, forget those. Just tell a story.
No, totally. I love it. It's just, No, I mean, she just makes it, and you know, her thing is like, she doesn't make it easy. You have to come over there.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I feel like each time you read her work, you get something different, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So there's another person here. Liz Moore, can you talk about your earliest experience with writing? Did you receive positive reinforcement from teachers or other adults, or was writing something that you did privately in any capacity?
Okay, first of all, hi, Liz Moore, the writer Liz Moore. I think I've said before somewhere that like, you know, when a famous actor's kids go into acting and they're like, I came up with this on my own. Like, my parents are not writers, but I feel like they were writing stage parents. Like, I was indoctrinated with literature, right? So my mom was really, they were both big readers, and my mom was a huge reader of like fiction by Black women. Mm. And she was always talking about the characters in these books like they were real people. And so early on, like, I just got a sense of that as something that was like happening, you know, like I still, you know, she'd say, yes, that person has that graveyard love. And I was like, you know, it's from Song of Solomon. And I thought like that was a real thing or whatever. And I just remember a day she spent telling me the entire plot of Their Eyes Were Watching God. And it was like, I still remember. And so, you know, I wrote little stories or whatever when I was little, and my sister and I are both writers. And I think it's something that it was just something we started doing. And then, we got feedback, but we also got feedback that it was like part of a tradition that was important in our house, you know? And like my father writes songs. So there was a lot of creativity there. And you know, I definitely got encouragement from teachers at different points. I remember this one time though, when I was in high school, I wrote a story that was like, it was kind of a horror story. And there were some gaps in it that were meant to like foster the horror. And the teacher took it really literally and like gave me a C, and it was like a huge outrage and all those kind of stuff. No. So, you know, there were haters, but mainly, you know, I definitely got a lot of positive feedback from family, from teachers, from people I showed things to. So I think that, and it was just something that I did to amuse myself as well.
Yeah, love it. Wow, all right. So Sally, you do have a lot of questions coming in actually as you're talking to Betsy Tanninger. I hope I'm not messing up her last name. I heard someone talking to a writer online the other day and wondering how they could write in this time of apocalypse. And the writer said, writers are always writing in a time of annihilation. Thoughts? Thanks. Can't wait to read the book.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's true. You know, I mean, I think that different writers definitely have different moments in the time of annihilation, and like There were times during this where I felt more annihilated than other times, you know, and so, and certainly it's not always, it's not possible to create if you don't have the basics, you know, but at the same time, like, it's, you know, you think about people who like were writing slave narratives to like get the slaves free, you know, it's like, and, you know, they were nominally free at the time, but that didn't mean they weren't living with annihilation and apocalypse, you know, or the generations of, you know, indigenous writers trying to like, sort of like testify from like the sort of like continuing destruction, you know? And so I think that that's like, I think that, you know, if we can do all the other things that we can do, like if you're able to do the other things that you do, you know, I mean, people keep working, people do, that's what part of what writing is. And also, you know, writing is something humans do to try to make sense of what's happening.
Yes.
And so it's not, you know, like certainly, but I think it's also true that for me and probably for a lot of other writers, the writing doesn't come from a place of like being, you know, satisfied and totally, you know, like complacent with your life. Like that's not gonna, you know, like from the earliest writing in one's journal about the indignities of like, you know, middle school slights or whatever, it is about trying to figure something out. So it kind of makes sense that people just keep continue writing through like different moments like that.
Yeah, definitely. And then even us, I mean, people have been doing it since, I mean, I remember I used to be so inundated by the questions during the Trump era, actually, you know, what is it like to be a writer in the time of Trump? You know, and I'm like, people have been writing.
There have been writers,
Yeah, so I always thought, you know, I mean, not that it's a stupid question, but still, I'm like, well, you just write, you know, deep into yourself. There's so much things that we can write about and also escape within ourselves, within our imaginations. Right. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So Ken Kalfus says, "Hiya, Sally. Congratulations on the novel. I wonder if you see a connection between the themes of your new book and Get Down and Disgruntled, your previous books."
I mean, so definitely, like, there's, you know, those books are also about racial identity and class and sexuality and Philadelphia. They're all set in Philadelphia. They're all about different parts of Philadelphia. And I think that the books all also, like, have these moments where people are examining themselves within, like, majority white settings and trying to calibrate their identity and thinking about that. I think that the big departure here is that this book is like, oh, is about adults. Now, with a caveat, it spends a lot of time in their youth because I'm never kind of leaving that behind. But I think that this is like, the difference is like, I think it's funny because I basically jumped from like middle school to like 40s. Like, yes. I mean, the other stuff is in it too, but it was like when I was finally ready to leave behind, like, seventh grade, I was like, okay, now I'm gonna write about 40-year-olds or whatever. But I think like there's definitely like, I'm always looking for the sort of like small, sharp observation about how life works, right? Like how these interactions between people work, you know, and what are the things that are, what are things that I've like seen that I've never read about? Right? That's something I'm always trying to think about. And that's, so it's not so much of a theme as something that I hope comes up in all of these books, like things that you've like certain kinds of phenomena that, you know, you've seen, but you haven't seen reported in literature.
That's very deep. Yeah. Very good. And Robin Riskin, actually, Dara Sally, you were actually my supervisor at Haverford College, and it's amazing to see and hear you here. Loving this conversation. I also wanted to ask if or how your teaching feeds into your writing process and vice versa.
So certainly when you're writing, you remember, it helps you think about how difficult it is to move from a space where you're looking at a blank page to move to a filled page, and that there's kind of a miracle in that. And so continuing to write really helps me get in touch with that and remember like the, you know, how hard that is. And I think like the, as far as like how the teaching is shaped, I mean, I think that like, I feel like I learn new things every day from teaching and from watching what students do that then I can take into the writing, right? Like things that students do to make things seem real or things that students do to make things humorous, like I remember those while I'm in the writing process.
Yeah. Yeah. I always think, you know, I learn from my students as well. You know, we teach them, but also they teach us.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. Beautiful and well said as well. So far, Karen Jordan.
But it's 8:30. Aren't we supposed to ring off now?
I know. I mean, Karen Jordan had said this. She said, ever discouraged from writing? Oh, have you ever been discouraged from writing? If so, what do they think of your success now?
The haters. No, I wasn't. I mean, I get all the rejection that writers get and all the discouragement that writers get in the course of things, but nobody actually has ever really, you know, done that in a way that like, would make a colorful story. So
beautiful, Asali. Well, you're an inspiration and thank you so much. This is amazing.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Yes. Congratulations again. And please, if you're listening, go pick up The Days of Afriki. You won't be disappointed. It's an amazing, amazing novel.
And then when you're done with that, by the way.
Oh,
you can read this book.
What a plug. I love it. Thank you.
Unflinching.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Good night, everyone. Night, Asali. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.